a speaker expert speaker. ACATRA Foundation presents the ACATRA Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of ACATRA AI.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into a memoir that, well, it really stands in fascinating contrast to the book that made its author a household name.
That's right. We're looking at Elizabeth Gilbert's 2019 memoir, All the Way to the River, a memoir of love, loss, and a different kind of journey.
And the contrast you mentioned is key, isn't it? Because Gilbert is, for so many people, synonymous with eat, pray, love, that huge, sprawling journey of self-discovery.
Exactly. A quest based on global escape, expansion, finding joy out there. This book, though, All the Way to the River, it feels like the profound, maybe more grown-up counterpart.
A grown-up owl.
Well, it requires a total opposite movement. Not expansion, but a kind of radical presence, even confinement. It's not about finding happiness in far-flung places.
It's about staying put.
Yes. It's about staying put through immense difficulty. Gilbert actually argues, pretty powerfully, that the deepest meaning isn't found in chasing your own happiness, but in the really raw, selfless act of accompanying someone you love to the very end. In this case, her best friend and partner, Raya Elias.
It's a story about presence, then, not pursuit.
That sums it up perfectly. Deliberately sort of dismantles that idea of the neat, triumphant, happy ending that we often crave.
Okay, so to really get the weight of that shift, we probably need a little context on Gilbert herself, where she started.
Definitely. The book gives us glimpses growing up on a Christmas tree farm in rural Connecticut. Sounds idyllic, but it fostered this this fierce self-reliance in her.
The kind that maybe leads to becoming a hard-bitten journalist,
yeah.
She's described her younger self.
Exactly that kind. Someone who can handle things, who maybe when things get tough emotionally, their instinct is to, well, to move. To pack a bag.
Which makes the core theme of this book staying all the more striking. She had to learn a whole new way of being.
A profound softening, you could say. Planting her feet right in the heart of something incredibly painful terminal illness when maybe her old reflex would have been to run.
And the reason she stays the anchor is her relationship with Raya Elias. Tell us about that bond.
It was deep. 15 years, she says, of this incredibly intimate but platonic friendship. Raya was this Syrian-born musician, filmmaker, apparently just a force of nature.
Someone who saw the real person behind the famous author.
That's the picture painted. Her anchor, her confidant, someone who cut through the noise.
A relationship most of the world didn't know about, though.
Not really, no. Not until the crisis. And the crisis, the trigger for this whole story, is Raya's diagnosis. Terminal pancreatic and liver cancer.
Bad kind of news.
Yeah.
It just changes everything, doesn't it? Puts everything else into sharp focus.
Absolutely. Her career, her obligations, and significantly, her marriage to Jose Nunez, the man from the Bali section of Eat, Pray, Love.
So the diagnosis wasn't just a medical event, it was an emotional detonation.
Completely. Gilbert describes this almost shattering personal breakthrough, realizing that her feelings for Raya weren't just friendship, but actually the truest, most essential love of her life.
Wow. And with a terminal diagnosis hanging over them.
Right. Suddenly hiding that love or delaying it felt impossible, unthinkable even.
That's incredibly complex. Leaving a marriage, the one her readers knew so well, for a love that was, well, facing such a difficult, finite future.
A huge ethical and emotional weight. But she made the decision to leave her marriage and commit completely to Raya, knowing the path ahead was caregiving, grief, service.
And that journey of caregiving becomes the heart of the book, right? The river of the title.
Yes. That's the core. And it moves from these big life decisions to the minute-by-minute reality.
You mean the practicalities?
Yeah.
The less romantic side of caregiving.
Exactly. She doesn't shy away from it at all. The river isn't just a metaphor. It's the relentless current of the illness. It's navigating hospital visits, insurance paperwork, managing pain.
Sleepless nights, exhaustion.
All of it. The sheer physical grind of lifting, giving meds, keeping track of everything. But, and this is crucial, it's juxtaposed with moments of incredible sacred intimacy.
So the mundane alongside the profound. Administering medication, yes,
yeah,
but also
right.
Holding a hand, just being there, witnessing.
It wasn't just physical care. It was a total commitment of presence. They even had this private, informal ceremony. Not a wedding for the future, but a promise.
A promise to see it through together.
To the end of the river, yes. Which is why Raya's eventual passing isn't framed as a defeat or losing a battle. It's framed as the river meeting the sea. Natural, inevitable, peaceful surrender. Grace.
That framing feels like a huge philosophical shift from her earlier work.
Yeah.
Eat, Pray, Love was about going out to find yourself, expanding your world.
Yeah.
This sounds like contracting.
Contracting, yes, but also deepening. It's a shift from expansive self-discovery to what you could call contracted self-surrender.
Surrender not as giving up, but...
but as yielding to what you can't control, like mortality. The idea isn't to find meaning by seeing more of the world, but by focusing your entire being on the immediate duty, caring for the person right in front of you.
So the ultimate spiritual practice isn't in an exotic location. It's in the messy reality of caregiving.
Right there, in the quiet, often exhausting, unglamorous work of just showing up, being radically present.
And that must have changed her understanding of love, too. It's less a feeling you find, more something you do.
Precisely. Love is a verb enacted daily. It's rooted in what she calls radical acceptance, showing up, serving, witnessing suffering without the need to fix what can't be fixed.
Which sounds simple, but doing it? That's the hard part.
That's the practice. Pragmatic devotion meets emotional surrender. It's not a cliche for her. It's learned through fire.
And she chose to live this incredibly private, intense experience quite publicly, announcing the relationship. It took courage.
Huge courage. It felt like an imperative for her, an act of authenticity. Announcing her separation and her love for Raya on social media, that was a statement.
A refusal to let shame or secrecy diminish it.
Exactly. A declaration that this love, despite the timing, despite the illness, was real and deserved to be honored, even with all the scrutiny that followed.
It's also a complete reversal of her old pattern, isn't it? The Eat, Pray, Love narrative started with fleeing the pain of divorce. Here, she's consciously moving towards the ultimate pain of terminal illness.
She had to invert her coping mechanisms, and her approach had this dual quality. Mm-hmm. On one hand, pragmatic devotion. She became, you know, an expert in oncology schedules, medication side effects, insurance.
Mastering the practicality.
Yes, but combined with emotional surrender, accepting she couldn't win a war against cancer, but she could offer the most profound gift. Unwavering presence, just bearing witness.
That feels like a major turning point in itself. And you've identified three key turning points in this whole story. The first, obviously, the diagnosis in spring 2016.
Yeah, that was the earthquake. It just vaporized everything else. All the smaller worries, the career stuff, the social complexities, gone.
And it didn't just change Raya's future. It fundamentally changed the nature of their relationship. In that instant,
it transformed that long friendship into this acknowledged, all-consuming love. No time left for ambiguity.
Which led directly to the second turning point.
Yeah.
The public announcement in September 2016.
Right. Taking that intensely private realization and making it public. It was like consecrating the relationship, saying this is real, this matters, even under the shadow of illness.
A huge act of personal honesty, especially given her public profile.
And it cemented their commitment in a way, refusing to let it be a secret love story.
And the third turning point feels more internal, more philosophical. The shift from fighting to accompanying.
This one is so important. They consciously decided to drop the war language. No more fighting cancer, battling the disease, beating the odds.
Why was that so crucial?
Because that language sets up a framework of winning or losing. It adds pressure and ultimately positions death as failure by shifting the mindset to accompanying Raya on her journey.
Gilbert's role changed.
Exactly. She wasn't a soldier trying to win an unwinnable war anymore. She was a companion, a witness. That allowed for peace, for acceptance. It reframed the whole experience. Not a battle against death, but a surrender to the process of life ending.
That shift opens up space for, well, for being human in the face of it all. And one thing that really hits home in the book is her honesty about not being a perfect caregiver.
Oh, absolutely. She's radically honest about the moments of impatience, the anger not at Raya, but at the illness itself, the moments of just sheer selfish despair, feeling overwhelmed.
Which is so important for anyone who's been a caregiver. It gives permission to be imperfect.
Completely. And she talks about how she recovered from those moments, not by trying to be superhuman, but through self-compassion, leaning hard on her support system, her friends, and just admitting, I can't be perfect at this. The goal wasn't perfection. It was returning to love and presence.
It's interesting, too, how the dynamic shifts. Raya, the one receiving care, becomes a kind of teacher for Gilbert.
A powerful role reversal. Raya's fierce honesty, her courage, her reported refusal to wallow in self-pity. Gilbert writes about learning profound lessons about strength and grace from her dying friend. The famous author becomes the student.
And those lessons are often found in these small, everyday moments she describes, aren't they? like the ice cream heist anecdote.
Ha, yes. That's such a great example. Raya's weak, barely able to speak, but she desperately wants this one specific decadent pint of ice cream from across town.
And Gilbert treats it like a mission of utmost importance.
Like a covert op. The seriousness, the focus, retrieving that specific ice cream becomes this small, defiant act of joy, a tiny victory against the encroaching darkness. It's about finding life in the midst of dying.
Or the way they created their own private language, the Dictionary of Pain.
Yeah, giving specific names to different types of pain. A sharp pain is a porcupine, a heavy ache, a bag of wet sand. It's intimate, creative.
A way to communicate suffering without resorting to cold clinical terms.
And it shows how crisis can actually breed this incredible intimacy and shared world building. They're making language beautiful even as life is falling apart.
It really underscores why this book resonates. It feels like an antidote to our curated, often superficial online lives.
It truly does. It forces you to confront vulnerability, mortality, and what actually matters in human connection, the messy, unglamorous, but deeply meaningful stuff.
It makes you think about what truly holds weight when time is limited. Which brings us perfectly to our final takeaways from this deep dive. Let's start with an emotional insight.
I think the core emotional takeaway is the profound, almost sacred intimacy found in the act of caregiving itself. That love isn't some grand prize you find, it's a practice. It's the relentless, daily, sometimes exhausting choice to show up for another person, especially when it's hardest. That's where the real holiness lies.
Beautifully put. Okay, an intellectual insight.
Intellectually, the big idea is the wisdom of surrender over conflict when facing the inevitable. You can't fight the river of time or loss. The real work is building the best boat you can, filling it with love, support, medicine, stories, and learning to navigate the current, cherishing the moments of peace.
Accepting the flow rather than fighting it. And finally, a universal insight for all of us.
I think it's about authenticity. Facing mortality, even vicariously through this story, clarifies what's truly important. Living a life aligned with your heart, loving who you love openly, it's not a luxury. It becomes an urgent necessity. The ultimate measure isn't avoiding pain, but loving bravely right through it. Host, speaker, expert, speaker. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.